Welcome to the Smart Tech Check podcast, hosted by Mark Vina, your home for candid, insightful, and provocative conversations about the smart home, home automation, security, smartphones, PC and console gaming, and much more.
Hi, everyone. My name is Mark Vina, host of the Smart Tech Check podcast. Today is Monday, June 16th. Walt Mossberg is one of the most respected voices in the history of technology journalism. For over two decades, he served as a principal tech journal columnist at the Wall Street Journal, helping everyday readers making sense of rapidly evolving computer technology. He later co-founded All Things D and Recode, pioneering a new era of digital tech coverage and live journalism. Known for his clear, no-nonsense reviews, Mossberg became a trusted guide during the rise of the personal computer, the internet, and the smartphone. Walt, as always, good afternoon, and welcome to the podcast.
I'm delighted to be here, Mark, with my old friend. But before we start, because we are friends, I just wanted to issue my condolences on the Yankees losing five straight to the mighty Boston Red Sox.
You know, and I applaud you for not texting me over the weekend because I was depressed. And, you know, I'm not a big drinker, but I will confess that I might have had a cocktail.
Well, because we're friends.
I appreciate that. Well, I do have a question for you before we get into the nitty gritty of the podcast. And I'm doing this as a public service announcement for America. I understand you've been married for 56 years, correct?
That's just right.
So that would be 1969. That would be Miracle Mets year stuff.
Uh-huh.
And I know you have a lovely wife. So the question I have for you, did you disclose to her that you were a Red Sox fan before you got married to her?
Yeah. She's from Boston. And we're both Red Sox fans. And, I mean, she wasn't that much into sports. But if you asked her, she would have said she was a Red Sox fan. And one of our earlier dates was at Fenway. Watching a ball game. I cannot remember which team they were playing. It might have been the Yankees. I don't know. But we did. I've told you this story, but and you can cut this out. If
No. Keep it. Go for it.
Of course, the greatest year for a Red Sox fan in this century was 2004 when, you know, they trounced the Yankees after being down
0-3. Yep.
Yes, and then they swept the World Series for the first time in 86 years, all that. And so the opening day game in 2005, they were giving out the rings and celebrating the World Series victory, as all teams do. And it happened that the opponent was the Yankees. And I have to say, we were there. It was freezing in April, as it often is in Boston. My wife and I were there with some friends. And I have to say, the Yankees were a tremendous class act on that day. Of course, the Yankees had won 26 or 27 World Series, whatever. And this was probably the eighth or ninth World Series the Red Sox had won, going way back to the beginning of baseball. And the first one in 86 years. And I want you to know that Joe Torre and Bernie Williams, and I want to say Derek Jeter, stood on the dugout, their dugout steps for the whole ceremony, clapped through the whole thing, to the point where the Red Sox manager, Terry Francona, walked over to Torre and tipped his hat.
That's amazing. Yeah, Joe Torre was a class act, so was Derek Jeter. You know, I mean, that's class. That's class.
That is class.
That is class.
We went on to beat the Yankees that day, but still, it was a class act.
Well, we can talk about the Red Sox forever because I know you've got, since I met you back in, 1991, I mean, we've always talked about baseball stories. And baseball, I have to say, is part of my life. It's part of my fabric. And
right. And
I'm sure, I know it's the same for you. We've talked about growing up around baseball, but let's talk about the things I would like to chat about. And I'm not going to go through. Everybody knows who you are. You know, you've had a remarkable career. Your Recode and All Things Digital interviews with Kara, the incredible Kara Swisher have been remarkable. They're really part of technology history as far as I'm concerned. I guess the question I have for you, you know, we're going to get into a lot of Apple-related stuff in a second, but what have you been doing since the retirement? I see you on social media from time to time. Kind of what's been filling up your days?
Well, some of my days are filled up with the most wonderful benefit of retirement, which is doing nothing. Watching TV, reading books, taking naps. It's great. But what I have really plunged into, and was one of the reasons I retired, actually, was to spend more time on this, is I'm the vice chair of an organization called the News Literacy Project, which I know you know about. And for those who don't know about it, it is a nonpartisan, totally nonpartisan, nonprofit organization which works in the schools, in middle schools and high schools. We have a digital curriculum. We have teacher training. And the whole idea is to teach kids not what to think, not who to vote for, but how to determine what they see online is false or true and why. And also things like what's in the First Amendment and stuff like that. So it's very rewarding. I've traveled around to a few high schools around the country to see it in action. And, you know, we've touched millions of kids and tens of thousands of teachers. I think we're in every state now. And we are actually one of our biggest states is, well, we have two big states that where the school districts have latched onto our stuff. And this will show you the nonpartisan nature. One is the LA school district, and there's other districts in California, but our big partnership in California is with the LA school district. And the other is Utah, where we have about six or seven big for Utah school districts that are partners, and we're working in the legislatures of those states to try to get them to pass what some other states have passed, including, by the way, Texas and New Jersey, which I know will interest you. They have passed these laws that say you have to take a course in media literacy in order to graduate. And not necessarily using our organization's materials, but some class in media literacy as an essential skill if you're going to go out there and become a voter and a citizen.
Now, I think it's remarkable work. Well, you should be applauded for that. No, full disclosure, I've made contributions to it, and I think it's exactly what we need. Frankly, you know, I'm saying that in a very much a nonpartisan way. I mean, part of the secret to cracking the nut in terms of what information is valid, what information is false, is following the practices articulated by this organization. And it's very much needed. So I applaud you on that work. That's great.
Thanks for your support.
No, that's great. Well, let's get into our fun topic here. I think it's an important topic before we get into Apple's WWDC, which is their worldwide development conference, which they have every June. I want to get your perspective, Walt, because I know you still kind of follow the company. I mean, you know, once you get technology in your blood, it's hard to get it out of your blood. How has the company evolved from your 40,000 foot view since those early days in the 1990s, when you had a one-on-one relationship with Jobs? And you've told me some memorable stories, both on and off the record, of some of those discussions, those phone calls he used to do. If he didn't like something of what you wrote, you know, you'd have these marathon phone sessions, to kind of where things are today. I mean, you did cover the company up until with Tim Cook era, up until 2017. That's not too many years ago. But give me your perspective on how things have changed from your perch.
Well, I covered really all the big tech companies. Yeah. including Apple, but also Microsoft, their big rival. And, you know, when Google started, when Facebook started, which were, by the way, years after I started in 1991. But my focus on Apple was particular because it was a company that wasn't interested in selling to IT departments, wasn't interested, as Jobs once said in an interview that I did with him on stage, Kara and I did with him on stage. They're not, he said, we're not very good at working through orifices. And it's a classic Jobs kind of thing to say. And so what he meant by that was working through the cell phone carriers, working through the IT departments. They really tried to make their stuff for the average mainstream person. And that was what my column was aimed at. So it was kind of a good fit. But to answer your question, when I started covering them in 1991, covering tech in general, Apple was a mess. It had been one of a handful of companies to essentially invent the PC in 1977. The others were
Radio Shack, Commodore
and Radio Shack, and they left the business, but Apple continued. And it had also been the company that pioneered the way PCs work up to today with the Mac in 1984. And so it had a lot of, you know, influence over the products, but it was not doing well. It couldn't sell the products. They were all very highly priced at a time when, you know, people didn't really know much about computers, didn't want to shell out $3,000 for a computer. And they'd gone through a series. About 6 years before I started, the board had fired Steve Jobs. And Steve Wozniak, his partner, was just working as an engineer. And the leadership of the company, they went through a bunch of CEOs. And it was bad. And then everything changed again in 1997 when they realized they were not going to be able to develop the kind of operating system needed to compete with Microsoft, and that they had too many products. They were all computers, but except for the Newton, which we're not going to get into.
Yeah.
But they... So they bought Steve Jobs' company.
Next. Yeah.
It was also not highly successful in selling hardware because he charged $10,000 for a computer. I mean, it was the computer that the web was invented on. Tim Berners-Lee, who invented the web, did it on a Next computer.
Computer, yes.
But... what Apple was really doing when they bought Next was buying the operating system, because that was a modern operating system, extremely robust, something that Apple had been trying to do and failing. And then Jobs killed a whole bunch of their excess products, pulled all the licenses from third-party manufacturers to use their OS, and he came out, I mean, the beginning of the revival of Apple, and he kind of tried to end the war with Microsoft, and Microsoft gave them
a bunch of money,
$50 million in non-voting stock. There's a whole, history behind that, including Microsoft had antitrust problems. And even though Apple had a very low share, they needed there to be another operating system that they could point to in court. And but the big thing Jobs did to begin the revival of Apple was the iMac in 1998,
right?
Which was dead simple to set up, way simpler than any PC. In fact, they ran ads showing that you could get on the you could open the box and 10 minutes later be on
you're online. Exactly. Oh yeah.
And with a, with an HP or something, you know, it was like an hour. So, that was the start. And then, you know, the history of all the, you know, the iPod and the, particularly the iPhone and the continuing evolution of the Macs, and then the iPad, and then after Jobs's death, they eventually came out with the Apple Watch, which has been successful, and the AirPods, which have been successful.
Right.
So that's sort of how it changed, but or that's what it did. But how did it change? It changed because Steve Jobs would bring out some new groundbreaking product, Apple under Steve Jobs, every couple of years. It was probably the most impressive run of new products in technology or even other industries, you know, game-changing products over a period of about whatever it was, 9 or 10 years, that we've ever seen. And then he died, and Tim Cook, who has taken over the company, took over the company at Jobs' request, and who I know dealt with directly, and even after my retirement, I won't go into why, but I had dealings with him that were that were productive. And he had, was not a product guy, and he admitted that. And Apple, the whole DNA of Apple was products. And they were vertically integrated, hardware and software, which was another odd thing. And so Cook tried to turn the product responsibilities over to various people. And you know, they did bring out the Apple Watch under Cook. And the Apple Watch is a, I think you would agree, a fairly successful product. We don't know the numbers because they don't break them out, but except to say, they've said several times, it's the most, not only the most popular smartwatch, but by some measures, the most popular watch in the world.
Yes.
And then the AirPods, which are also not broken out, but obviously extremely successful. So Tim Cook, the way that I would look at it is, Tim Cook was a very, and is a very smart operations guy, which had been his job before. And a under him, they've become a financial behemoth. They've become the biggest company in the world by market cap. Their results have typically been, they've beaten Wall Street's predictions. They've, if you're an Apple shareholder, you've done very well over these years. But there's only so long that can be the backbone of your company. You have got, if you're Apple, you've got to bring out blockbuster new products. And it's been really a long time since Tim Cook's Apple has done that.
And I would argue that one of Tim Cook's biggest contributions is really turning Apple into a services business. You know, if you look at a lot of the revenue now, a lot of the growth comes from the services end of their business.
But upselling your existing customer base to new things and getting them to subscribe to new things I think it has a natural limitation. You've got to do something.
Yes.
And they tried to do a car for a while and couldn't do that. Or, you know, the software for the car, somebody will write a book explaining it all, but whatever. They invested a lot of money and nothing has come of it.
Well, the Vision Pro has been kind of
a product called the Vision Pro, which was an amazing piece of engineering, and I think showed a lot of the future of mixed reality, but cost a fortune, had terribly short battery life, and I think has probably sold maybe 500,000 units, if I'm generous. And so he hasn't succeeded. And in terms of AI, no one knows how Steve Jobs would have handled it, except he did buy Siri. And I once asked him on stage, something I said, well, Siri is your entry into search, right? And he said, no, Siri is not search. Siri is intelligence or something like that. So he had this, as usual, far off vision of what he was doing, but he was very sick by then. He died not too long after, and Siri just languished. Apple had about a 5-year lead on everyone else and wasted it. They just didn't do it. And I would say even today, unless they make good on the promises they've made to turn Siri into a truly AI product, it's not what it needs to be. So that's my view on Apple is they need something more than just upselling people that are already their customers to the next feature set.
No, they haven't had a breakthrough product in terms of even something like the Apple Watch, which obviously has been a huge revenue contributor. And most people would say they're kind of the de facto leaders in that wearable space. But here's a quick, before we get into the WWDC portion and the next slide, the question I really wanted to ask you is that, you know, as I've been engaging with Apple, both their, you know, at covering them externally and also visiting the campus last week and, you know, visiting with Apple executives behind the scenes, which I can't go into from a dialogue standpoint, just like,
yeah, I know I've done 100 of them. I know.
Yeah. So, you know what I'm talking about. The thing that's remarkable to me, and I mean this as a positive thing, it may not come out the right way, but you know, you and I would have multiple press briefings before when we announced the product or before under NDA. And I always felt comfortable enough with me that if you asked me a question about, Mark, why didn't you do this? And I would say something off the record.
Compact and Dell.
Yeah. But I would say to you, well, off the record, we didn't do it for this reason, but we may do this 6 months from now. But I would know you would respect that off the record type of discussion. The thing that's remarkable to me is that, first of all, Apple doesn't really, they really don't generally have a lot of analyst briefings. So I'm lucky that I had that kind of, I've had that kind of dialogue with them. And I won't get into the conversations themselves. But the thing that's remarkable to me is how well scripted even these smaller sessions were with some very senior people that were presenting to me. And it's very small groups, 5 or 6 people. And so that's one thing. It's almost like they rehearsed a dialogue for an hour. And then the second piece
was an hour, I assure you.
Oh, yeah. No, they didn't rehearse it for an hour. I'm talking about the length of time you have generally with these executives. But the other piece was these sessions generally have a very senior person and a little bit of a junior person, director level type of person. And they're equally, you know, well prepared. You know, I mean, it's almost like a Broadway show in terms of the way it's. Was it like that during your? I know you interfaced quite a bit with Jobs, quite a bit.
Yeah, we're always very disciplined, but just like you're saying, they didn't leak a lot unless mm-hmm. they delivered. I saw products, including the iPhone, before the world saw them or they went on sale, and. You know, I can still remember seeing the iPad for the first time. And it's because I had a relationship with the CEO that was unusual. And he trusted me and I, you know, lived up to my side of the deal. And I got an embargo date and it allowed me to be first or one of the first one or two to have a review. So I thought it was a good exchange, but, and my reviews, by the way, were of those things were not 100% positive.
Yes. Oh no. That seems to be kind of,
they were 80% positive. They weren't 100% positive. And sometimes they were 80% negative, you know, it just depended. Yes, they were hugely disciplined. I have never seen anything quite like, last week, I didn't go, by the way, but not only did I watch it all, but I also on social media have watched the complete, they did a series of interviews.
Yes.
With not just a senior and a junior person, but two very senior people that report directly to Cook. One was Craig Federighi, their software guy, and the other was Craig Joswiak, who's the head of all product marketing. And they sat down together, and I don't know how many they did, but it looked to me like they at least did five or six. And their goal was to, they knew what the reporters were likely to ask, and their goal was to explain why some of the things they promised last year for AI, which they call Apple Intelligence, have not surfaced yet, and why. And they came up with this explanation that there were really two stages to building these things, and they realized they were on what they promised last year was really stage one. And then they got to realizing that they weren't going to be able to deliver stage one. So they just decided to go to town on stage two, and that'll be delivered within the next year, which probably means 2026. They knew they couldn't ignore it. So they had an explanation. I'm not saying it's a false explanation, maybe 100% true, but they stuck to it if you look at those interviews, it's amazing. I mean, you know, there's different reporters who have different angles, different ways of trying to ask a question. And I know most of these reporters and reviewers, and I even mentored a bunch of them, and they're top notch. But no matter how they tried to go around it, and they got some things from
but they stay on message. That's what you're trying to say.
Stay on message. It's like it's like a person running for office for president or whatever, senator, whatever they're running for. Their staff is always telling them, stay on message. Please. Regardless what the press asks you, you answer the question you want to answer. Regardless of where you're making the speech, whether it's to, you know, a conference of like the business roundtable or a bunch of unions or just a big rally or a small group of donors, stay on message.
Now, and I will
really what Apple was doing last week.
Yes. And now what I will say, because I was there in person, you know, and I'll tell you, you've been to these a million of these sessions, you know, but, you know, you in some ways, I don't like to be there on site because what you really see is Tim Cook and Craig comes out. Hey, welcome to WWC. Then they walk off stage and they play a video. Well,
since the pandemic.
Yes, correct.
On video, the value of being there on site, I think, has declined quite a bit.
Yeah. So they're trying to fix that, you know, in terms of the one-on-one meetings and things like that. But I will say, and this one I want to get your reaction to, I mean, Craig Federighi came as close to an apology that you'll ever hear where he basically says, yeah, you know, we promised a lot with Apple Intelligence. And they followed up in a lot of those interviews that you referenced saying, you know, it wasn't smoke and mirrors. We had the stuff kind of working, but it wasn't meeting the bar.
I heard that. He said it in multiple interviews.
Right. Now, the thing I will say, though, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, he insisted that what they had was working in last year's conference. But when they tried to actually productize it and get it out of the market,
it wasn't ready for prime time.
Yeah. It wasn't up to their standards, they said. And so they moved on to the next version of it. That's their story.
Well, and the reason why I have respect for that now, and I don't want to come across as an Apple apologist because I'm not, because I come out of the Windows world. But what I would say is they knew they had a kind of a messaging challenge going into this WWDC. They, you know, they're not stupid. They have very, very seasoned executives. And someone like myself who has worked at very senior levels, like at Compaq and at Dell, you know, there's always pressure that when you have a big announcement event that you're going to announce something material that's going to change the world. So I am sure they were under tremendous pressure to, hey, we got to make this more substantial than, hey, we're just going to get Apple Intelligence to work, which is essentially what their message was. So I have to give them kudos for just to have that kind of restraint. You know, I and you might say, well, you know, that's the responsible thing to do. Well, at the end of the day, you know,
they are very good at staying on message. And by and large, I think those executives were being honest, not giving you every detail. I mean, you know, there might have been fights inside. There might have been they might have thought they could deliver what they did last year, and there was a point where somebody had to decide, oh, this isn't going to work, and we need to, you know, whatever.
Right.
Not giving you every detail, but the basics probably are correct. And so what did they do to fill in the space? They overhauled the cosmetic look of every single product. They added features, not huge features, to most of the products. I actually personally think the most important, let's put AI to the side, or Apple Intelligence to the side. We can judge it when they actually roll out. They've rolled out a little of it, but when they roll out more of it.
Right.
I think the most impressive thing was the iPad, actually.
Yes.
Because the iPad is now essentially a touchpad, a touch screen.
Yes, a computer. Yes, exactly.
Screen Mac. Well, it always was a computer, but for productivity purposes and things, you know, I don't think it's what a video editor or, you know, some kind of 50 spreadsheet set of time person is going to still want to use. But for most people, the vast majority, 85-90% of people, there's everything in there now. There's everything. It runs.
I want to get your reaction to that, because I do believe, and this has been my hypothesis, and I think you and I have talked about this before, at a certain point, macOS and iPadOS come together. I mean, because if there's too much efficiency you get if you get engineers working on a single platform, and you have a common, you know, you have common silicon right now, which makes life a lot easier. But here's my hypothesis that I want to get your reaction to. You know, they've been very resistant to adding touch to the classic clamshell notebook. Microsoft has done that for years. I know Microsoft would dispute this, but I'm not sure touch on a conventional clamshell or even convertible Windows notebook has really lit the world on fire, to be honest with you.
I agree.
And the question, hypothesis I have is that at some point, maybe it's next year, maybe it's the following year, when you start to see foldable tablets, which exist right now, that can, you know, you can take, let's say, a 15-inch tablet, a supersized iPad that can fold in half, that essentially becomes a clamshell notebook, but also and creates an interesting type of usage models. That's when Apple could come to the point and say, you know what, we're going to come up with a brand new form factor. It's a tablet that also can operate as a desktop in a clamshell type of manner. It will have touch, but we still don't believe touch on a traditional clamshell notebook makes sense. But it does make sense, you know, in this new world, you know, and it'll be years for that to come together, because those will initially be very expensive. They're not going to be, you know, $500 computers. But I just think that, and you tell me this is where if I'm wrong here, I think Apple has a long view, that there's that iPadOS has been going through these evolutions for the last several years.
They have a long view, and they respond to a pressure from customers and analysts and journalists and everybody else. And they don't talk about it, but I think they agree with a lot of it.
Mm-hmm.
One thing I would say is, two things. First of all, iPads are being used as clamshell computers because they have that very, very nice keyboard that goes on them. You know, it costs money, but it's a very, very nice. And if you do that now with these new, now that you can put in 6 windows and have them floating around and just use the Mac toolbar, which you've been used to, and I can't even think of there's 2 or 3 other things in iPadOS, you can use it almost like you use a Mac. I mean,
now it's got a robust file manager, which has been their weakness in the past. Now it's got multitasking. I played with it while I was at the event, and it truly, you know, gives you pause. You know, the only thing I can think of that the iPad OS doesn't have, it doesn't have the legacy peripheral compatibility that a desktop operating system has. But even that is, you know, the reason why you would use a desktop operating system is that legacy peripherals work with it. You just plug it in and there are drivers already there. iPad OS is not exactly there yet.
Well, and legacy software. I mean, software we're using to make this runs on computers, and they highly recommend Chrome. Now, Chrome is on the iPad, but it's a little different. And, you know, they may never care very much about that stuff. The second thing I wanted to say was, you mentioned foldable tablets. First of all, I don't think they need that to make the iPad a, you know, the computer that where you barely ever touch your laptop. But if they were going to do it, the thing about Apple is they will never do a foldable computer where you can even see the slightest crease.
Yes.
Where you can even hear the slightest sound from the hinge. Where there's any downside to it, it just works.
And no, I thoroughly agree with that. That will not be a lot about some of the foldable phones are out there right now that after repeated use, you can see the crease. That will never happen.
They will never allow that. And so that will take time and cost more. They're already working on it. If they intend to bring that out, they've been working on it 2 years already. And I'm sure these are the first things they, you know, dove into. Ours has to be different and better, and people have to see this.
Right.
And some of that also is software. Don't ask me what, but something about when you open it up, something will happen that is a little different than other people's foldables. But I do not think they need a foldable for instance, they could make the iPad so it ran an external monitor. Mm-hmm. I can't remember, maybe it can, but
it does. No, you can do that right now.
I mean, it's I use it a ton right now, and I can't wait to get.
No, I'm getting very close. You and I have had this discussion before. You know, when I go on the road, I bring my nuclear football bag with me, which has every device because I'm doing stuff a lot remotely, and I would love not to bring my MacBook Pro. I would love to just to have my iPad that I could do some serious work on it. Now you've got the multitasking issue addressed for the most part. You've got file manager, which is a big deal in terms of where you move around files on your computer. And hey, let's face it, if I'm in a hotel room, it's pretty easy to attach my iPad to a big monitor, you know, in the room. So I think they're getting pretty close. I mean, to use a football analogy, I think they're on the 5-yard line, you know, in terms of.
But their official statement is they're not merging them. So,
you know, well, that will be the official statement until they actually announce that.
Right.
You know, so, but overall, how would you grade the WWDC? I mean, did you, so.
Well, it was not, I mean, first of all, there's a difference between WWDC and special events. When Steve Jobs was running the company, which is really the beginning in 1997 of modern Apple.
Right.
He didn't make much distinction between the two things. It wasn't. Now we know not to expect hardware at WWDC and not to expect software in the fall and sometimes in March when they have another special event. But he just use them all as platforms for announcements, sometimes software, sometimes hardware, sometimes both. And so it's important, I think, for viewers and listeners to understand that WWDC is primarily a software thing. There's not a burden on them to come out with new hardware now. There will be in the fall, but not now.
Right.
So that's the first thing. If I'm comparing it to the Tim Cook WWDCs, or certainly the Steve Jobs WWDCs toward the end of his life, you know, this was one of the less impressive ones. like I say, it was, it could have been a, I think it could have been a special event covering two things, basically, the three things, the apology on the AI, the overhaul of the UX with that, what do they call it? Liquid glass.
Liquid glass, which is very cool.
Which is very cool, but I've read some very smart reviews which said at the moment it's almost too transparent for your workflow, and so they're going to have to fix that. And it's exactly the kind of thing you do fix when you go through your betas and things.
Yes.
And then the third thing would have been the iPad, and that could have been what, and this could have been a special event, but of course they need the WWDC for their developers. What we, I don't know about you, I won't speak for you, but what most people who watch that watch is the keynote. And if they can watch it, some of the interviews and side events, a lot of which are off the record, but some of which are on the record. But the, as you know, the event goes on for a week.
Yes, yes.
Okay. And they do another big speech called the State of the Union, which is more techie and more aimed at, you know, it's all about SDKs and APIs and coding languages and, you know, all this kind of stuff that most people, even Apple shareholders and others, never watch. And then they do a ton of, they have like 1,000 of their engineers there, and the developers send their engineers and they work together and they, you know, all of that. And so they need this conference for that. And other companies have very similar conferences.
Right. I think what people got seduced by during the Steve Jobs era, Walt, was that whole one more thing type of thing that he, which he did a few times where, hey, before the event ends, let me show you something. I think he did it famously with the MacBook Air. He pulled it out of an envelope. Yeah, which
it's still the best laptop ever made.
There you go. Hey, listen, he created a category. That category didn't exist. Now, you know, without getting into a lot of a debate on this, I mean, there's been improvements now with chips in the Windows world, chiefly Qualcomm with their Snapdragon stuff, where it competes very effectively, you know, with the Apple architecture. Now, the downside is that they're Windows platforms. So if you're either in the ecosystem, you're not in the ecosystem. And obviously, if you buy a Qualcomm SoC-based thin and light notebook, my point is a lot of that differentiation that Apple used to have has kind of gone away from a battery life standpoint and some of the other benefits you used to have with Apple. But they still own the ecosystem when it comes to the smartphone. And they'll never give up on that, by the way. They will never give away the keys to the kingdom. You will never be able to do a text message, an iMessage text message on a Windows platform in a non-kludgy manner. There are a couple of third-party solutions out there that are terrible. But and you got to give them credit because they want to keep people in the ecosystem, you know?
Right. I agree.
So, but let's talk a little bit about, let me bring this slide up here. You know, before we actually ask this, do you use some of the ChatGPT and others, the other tools that are out there?
I'm only speaking for myself.
Yeah.
This isn't a recommendation to the world, although it's actually, it's not a bad idea for the world. I don't trust Google. I admire Google. I admire Sundar, who I know very well.
Mm-hmm.
They're terrific at certain things. But I don't trust them on privacy. And privacy matters to me. So I've been using DuckDuckGo as my search for a long time. And you can laugh at that, but it actually, you know, it's based on Bing. It works quite well. And it strips all the trackers off everything you do. So I've been using Google for search for years. I have it on my phone twice a year. I may feel the need to do it. But I will tell you that since ChatGPT came out, I think I have the plus version. You don't have to have the plus version. And I know there's an even costlier one. think it cost me $20 a month.
Yeah.
And there's no ads. Maybe they'll put ads in. I don't know. But I use that for search. I know you can do a lot more with it. And people say, well, if you only use it for search, you're not really getting the most out of it. And I'm sure that's true. But I love just saying something in natural language. And, you know, we all know it will be completely wrong in a way that Google search, which is just giving you links and a little summary, will not be completely wrong. But I have found it to be a very good, particularly because they give their sources, I found it to be a very good substitute for search.
Oh, I agree with you. I mean, the beauty of ChatGPT, and they've officially become my go-to search tool, because you can ask complex questions. I increasingly will sometimes ask ChatGPT, how do you do a certain thing in a feature in a product? And it will give you a pretty good.
I've done that 16 times already. Mm-hmm. And it will give you a step-by-step
tutorial.
And let's say it's an Apple thing, just because we've been talking about Apple. It will actually take from Apple's support site, as well as a couple of maybe third-party sites that follow Apple, where people have shown you, or YouTube videos where people have shown you how to do this, and it will give you a step-by-step, and it's correct. I mean, I've followed it, and then it's correct. Yes, I use ChatGPT for search. Now, I do want to say this, going back to Siri. By the way, I've known about Siri since before Apple bought it. Kara Swisher and I put it on stage at our D conference when it was in the brief period when it was an independent third-party app on the App Store, and they demoed it. And it was amazing. And Jobs bought it 3 months or 4 months later. And then it died a slow, strangulation inside Apple. But when you talk about Apple Intelligence and how much or how little of it they brought out, I start with Siri and I ask a complicated question. And Siri is still large, not 100%, but largely incapable of carrying on a conversation and doing what in search they call remembering state, meaning it remembers what you were talking about
before.
So for instance, people can try this on a ChatGPT or even on some of the other companies' products. If you say, how many sheep are there in New Zealand? It'll tell you. And then without referring to New Zealand again, if you say, what's the population? It'll give you the population. Then if you say, who's the prime minister? It'll tell you who the prime minister is. And if you say, where is it located? It'll tell you where it's located. It remembers the whole
thing. It's very context aware in that thread. Yes. No, I agree.
And so if Siri actually does that a little bit today, but if there's an argument for using Siri, which is that when you get too complicated for Siri, there's just a button to go to ChatGPT, which mm-hmm. I've done also. I don't know if you've done that.
Yes, I have.
And then it's as if you started with ChatGPT, So if I asked how many sheep there are in New Zealand, I'm not sure it would remember the rest of it. But then if I asked, well, who's the prime minister, it might say, you want to go to ChatGPT for that. So, yeah, I do. I think actually in a lot of ways, it's a bigger threat to Google than to Apple because it's most people who are using it today, not all, but most are using it like you and I are as their primary search tool.
Now, yeah, it's ability just to understand complex prompts, It's amazing, and put it in perspective.
Well, I've also made illustrations with it and done other things.
Right.
I asked it to make an illustration of my house, and I gave it the address of my house, If I asked it to make an illustration of me, I don't have to do anything but put my name in because there's pictures of me all over the web.
Right.
And it doesn't do a fantastic job, but I mean, it does a decent job, but not a fantastic job. My house, it said, because there's not pictures of my house on the web, or maybe in Zillow, maybe in Google and Apple Maps, you know, they have pictures of your house, but there's not a lot. So it said, can you upload a picture? So I uploaded a photo of my house, and it took a little while. It said, you know, waiting, thinking, painting in the details, and it gave me back, you know, if there was a painter sitting at the end of my driveway painting my house, it would kind of look like what they brought back. And then I began to look at it closely, and like, I have a wrought iron rail, two wrought iron rails on my front steps, but ChatGPT only gave me one wrought iron rail and it was bent. I have two windows over here on one side of my house. There's only one window there. I have a two-car garage that's been converted into a family room and has regular windows, but no garage door. In the ChatGPT version, there's a garage door. So it makes some mistakes, but at first glance, even at second glance, you would say, well, that's a pretty good rendering. Now, to your question on the slide, is Apple Intelligence the company's future? I feel like if they don't get an impressive, accurate version of Apple Intelligence running soon, it will be an enormous problem for them. If they do get it, and they follow their strategy, which is different than almost everybody else's, and their promises emerge as real, it could be a huge part of their future. But the company's future, I may be completely wrong, but I think the company's future is still hardware and software that knocks your socks off. And Apple Intelligence will help knock your socks off, because as you know, and they patiently explain in their scripted statements and interviews, they're not trying to build a chatbot. That's why they signed the deal with OpenAI.
Exactly, exactly.
They are trying to put it everywhere.
Right.
In the system, in the Photos app, we already talked about search, in the Spotlight thing, which searches the whole phone and can also search the web. But in every little place on the phone, there's going to be, intelligent AI, where you can count on it to remember the state of what you're talking about, where you can count on it. If I say, show me a picture of Mark Vina, I don't know how many pictures of you I have, but probably not.
Right.
I might have a dozen pictures of you out of, I don't know, 35,000 pictures. Right now, if I say, find me a picture of Mark Vina, doesn't do very well on that.
Right.
If they can do what they're promising and build it into everything, when I say, find me a picture of Mark Vina out of 35,000 pictures, it ought to just find you and pluck it out. Right.
But that's going to require, and that's where Apple has an advantage versus other companies in terms of trust. You know, that if those photos, for example, you're referencing were on your phone, you know, you may not want Apple Intelligence to have access to certain photos, but not all photos for whatever reason. And I just think that Apple has that advantage. And I think your point is right that, you know, I'm not saying that it's going to, that if they fail at Apple Intelligence or at least completing the promise, it's going to, you know, cause the company to go backward, but it certainly helps from a hardware layer.
Oh, I think if they fail at AI, it will be a blow to the company. I don't think
it'll be significant. Sure.
It'll be a blow, but I don't expect them to totally fail at AI. There may be people, you know, if, as we just discussed, their method is to spread it out over everything and not have a chatbot. And they'll just use ChatGPT, or as you know, I can't think of a chatbot that you can't download to Apple's products right now and use them.
But they've made a bet to stay with OpenAI, and I think they've done that, frankly, because it concentrates their engineering efforts to get it. Not the fact that OpenAI.
On my iPhone, the ChatGPT icon is on the front page because I use it as search. I don't go to Safari or Chrome or the Google app to search anymore. For the most part, I go to the ChatGPT thing. But so I don't think it'll destroy the company, but I think it will deeply weaken the company if they can't get AI. And I assume that because of that, they will get AI.
Well, and they've taken the actions internally. You know, the inside baseball, they've reorganized and they've moved. You know how the way Apple operates is that when an area is failing for whatever reason, hardware or software, the best and the brightest resources get reallocated. They're not public about that, but they do take the necessary
action. You better believe they're pouring every ounce of effort into making it work.
Oh, yeah. No, I agree.
So I think it will work. And to the extent AI is the future of not just computing, but, you know, how we conduct our lives, I think they will try to keep up with that. If they decide a chatbot is what's needed, they'll try to build a chatbot or buy one. But right now, I think they have a reasonable Apple-like strategy. Remember, they're an integrated. They've always been integrated. And so if you integrate AI through everything they have, that's very Apple.
Right. You know, and you'd be very generous with your time, Walt. We've gone way over what I thought we would.
You're going to have to edit. I don't know.
I don't know. But people want to hear. They love hearing stuff like this. I think this will be a very valuable podcast for a lot of folks. I want to just bring up, you know, back in 2017, you did write, you know, you, I don't know whether you coined the phrase, but you did write a column on this ambient computing. Now you meant that, I believe, in an Apple wearables watch. Was it something else?
I mentioned the watch, but no, that's not what I meant. It was much broader. It was not really about Apple. The title of the column was The Disappearing Computer.
Yes. Okay.
The time frame I put on it at the time in 2017 was 10 to 20 years. And the idea was, and I did use, and I had a section called ambient computing. And again, I don't know if I coined it. I wasn't sitting there thinking, oh, I'll coin a term, but I later realized not that many people were using it. So, I mean, somebody else may have coined it. I don't know. But, it wasn't in popular use when I used the term. And I was talking about computing being all around you, kind of like on Star Trek, where they have computers of some type, of various kinds on the Starship Enterprise, but the captain or anyone doesn't have to sit down in front of something. They can just say...
His voice.
You know, where is Mark Vena? Where is Lieutenant Mark Vena? Right. And they'll tell you he's in the lunchroom, or he's in the engine room, or he's not on the ship.
Right.
Which sets off a big crisis. Why is he not on the ship? What happened to him? You know, whatever. And so I talked about smart sheetrock, smart drywall, smart roads. Smart, you know, sensors in everything, so that the things we use for computing today. I mean, I'm on an iMac. I don't know what you're on, but and it's lovely and it works great. But we ought to be able to have this conversation without a piece of whatever this is made of, titanium or aluminium, as Johnny Ive used to like to say, without that in front of us. So that was my last column.
Well, the reason why I think this topic is so important is that, as you know, Johnny Ive and Sam Altman have kind of combined forces. Altman has been very, you know, specific that they will be coming out with some type of wearable device. And where I'm going with this, because it ties to a lot of topics we've been talking about for the last hour or so, is that imagine, if you will, some type of wearable device that's monitoring your conversations 24/7. And now we have, by the way, you know, there's a company called Limitless that has a pendant that you can wear that will listen to your conversations for note taking. But let me run this kind of Mark Vina hypothesis by you. And this, by the way, requires an enormous amount of trust. I'm not even sure even Apple could rationalize this amount of trust on the user. But if it's monitoring your conversations 24/7, both public and private, your voice messages, your calls, you got email that you could have these bots monitor. Think of the usage models that may come out of that, where you and I could be talking about 11 o'clock in the morning, and I happen to just mention in passing that I'm going to stop and get a pizza when I'm going to watch the Yankee game that night. And then it reminds you at 6 o'clock by saying, hey, by the way, you know, a voice comes along, you know, in a very friendly, probably a British voice. By the way, you told that your guest, Walt Mossberg, that he was coming over for pizza. Should I order a pizza from your favorite place? And by the way, we know that you're three blocks away from your favorite place. This would be, should we place an order for you? Now, that's kind of a ridiculous example. But I think this is coming. I think that kind of usage model is coming.
Well, I could be wrong. I'm not an AI expert, but I think some of these AIs that we already have, if you allow them to, can read your texts and email without a pendant or anything. They can read it.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
They're on your device. And if you type that as a reminder to yourself, they may not necessarily talk to you, but they may pop up something that says, on your calendar or on your reminders, you have 6 p.m. Yankees game watching at your house with Walt Mossberg.
Or it could be something like
that. Think that can be done today. Here's the thing about 24 hours monitoring what you say. Well, first of all, here's the thing about hardware AI. I have a lot of respect for Johnny Ive, tremendous respect. But Johnny Ive is primarily a software interface guy. When they turned hardware design over to him, he constantly had fights with the engineers. It didn't really work perfectly, and I think it eventually led to his departure. In fact, I can't prove this, but I have been told by people I trust implicitly, high up people, that at one point he just wanted to let the MacBook Air go away, mm-hmm. and to make the MacBook Pro thin, which he did, by the way. But they wouldn't let him get rid of the MacBook Air. He's not a fantastic hardware guy, and I don't think Sam Altman is either. Now, there may be people below them, companies that OpenAI has bought, or people that Johnny Ive has working for him who are fantastic hardware engineers. So that's the first thing. Second thing is what you mentioned, which is trust. I mean, I wouldn't wear a pendant like that. I think you're not wearing a pendant like that. And I just wouldn't wear it. I'm sure there's a button that says turn off listening, but you don't know. What was
the name? No, I agree with you. I put a big out.
Companies, you don't know what they're going to do. And there, to quote you earlier, Apple does have some advantage in that they are considered
a trustworthy entity. Yes.
And even their current AI system, as you know, they do a lot of it on device, more than I think their competitors. And then they have a bunch of their own servers, which they claim even they can't figure out what's being looked up by you.
Sure. Yes, correct.
And only then do they send you to ChatGPT, which is controlled by somebody else and not necessarily private. And before they do that, they say, do you want to go to ChatGPT? It doesn't have the privacy we do, but it knows a lot, or something like that. And then you hit the button. So, you know, they certainly can make, I mean, if they can make this watch and the Ultra version, which is even more elaborate, they can make a pendant that can listen to your speech and all that. And maybe they can, maybe they have enough trust and privacy to make it work. But I think they are the extreme case of trust. And particularly, I mean, a startup would have no trust, even if it was good people.
No,
Microsoft would have no trust. Google would have no trust. So, there's a difference. Microsoft would have more trust than Google, but not entirely. So I have great doubts about. Now, there may be some other things the hardware can do that you didn't describe, but.
Well, it could be something as simple as that. You and I were talking in passing about me getting a plane ticket to fly from A to B, and it reminded you. You know, and the key is that's a bit different from what you described, is that this would be a proactive tool. In other words, I didn't have to remember, hey, remind me about something later in the day. That based on your dialogue during the day.
Hey, I know. And there are lots of people. You know how if you look up something on Facebook, if you respond to an ad on Facebook for, I don't know, socks. You'll suddenly see a ton of ads about socks, and people will swear that they never put it into Facebook and that Facebook is listening to them and is able to figure out that they.
No, I'm well aware of that.
Yeah. That's not true, but people believe that. An amazing number of people believe that. And they're not happy about it. And I don't think some kind of wearable would do it. If you wanted. I mean, if it became something that took off and everyone in the world wanted it, Apple could easily put it into AirPods or the Apple Watch.
Yeah. I mean, we're gonna have to wrap it up here because I appreciate your time, Walt. I mean, to me, I think you're right. Even with Apple's enormous trust reputation, you could see something like this going south. You know, and that which could be devastating because once you go south, you know, it's hard to recover customers' trust. Now, having said that, the marketing guy in me says, hey, yeah, there's some interesting usage models that come out of this that could blow people away. And people might rationalize, yeah, you know, my privacy goes out the window, but I can do these five or six things. That kind of scares me when you have that type of mentality, because, once you violate privacy and things, especially exposure to your text messages and your voicemails, and that's kind of, you know, I mean... It's like, 2001 Space Odyssey when Hal is reading the astronaut's lips at the end. And by the way, I think I saw a patent that Apple's working on something like that, which is kind of crazy. But anyway, why don't we wrap it up here? Any closing thoughts, Walt, before we kind of sign off here?
Well, we're talking about Apple, and they are stuck a little at the moment. We'll see if they can come unstuck. I think there's just one area that we didn't touch on, and that's health. Mm-hmm. They are, and I can't think of an interview where Cook didn't mention it. Yeah. We know they have a secret lab. It's unlabeled. I think it's in Sunnyvale or somewhere where they're trying to figure out how to do glucose readings for diabetics without a needle and without something sticking in your body 24/7 or even
based on your perspiration or something like that.
I mean, they could read the molecule through your blood. I don't know what it is. If you don't think that's a multi-billion dollar business, it's a multi-billion dollar business if they could do that. So when we watch them and the industry as a whole, health breakthroughs are important to watch.
Oh, yeah. No, I agree. And I'll just sign off by saying this. You know, I'm sure you saw the little piece on Workout Buddy, which is I told the team there when I saw the announcement during WDC, there's so many Hans and Franz videos you could do for celebrity voices encouraging you to work out. a lot harder. But, yeah, there's going to be a lot of interesting stuff coming along. I do think the health thing it continues to be a big, big focus. For Apple, and I think you're right about that. But Walt, again, thanks for taking the time to join me for today's podcast.
Anytime for you.
Well, I appreciate that.
Particularly when the Yankees have lost 5 straight to the Red Sox.
You had to get that in there. For our viewing and listening audience, thanks for making the Smart Tech Check podcast part of your day or commute. Please make sure that you hit the like and subscribe buttons at the end of today's podcast or use these on-screen QR codes to connect with me. You can also follow me on X at MarkVitaTechGuy. And until next time, have a great week. And Walt, again, thanks for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Mark. Take care.